Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hi, welcome to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Heather, and I'm the chair of this week's podcast, and what an exciting episode this is going to be. This week, I'm joined by Steph, Teresa, Nicola, Linda, and Pat.
Hi! Hi.
This week, Steph will be asking us to name the novel, Linda will be reading from a work in progress, Nicola will be amusing us with a thought this week, and our celebrity interview with Sam Blake, and we'll all be talking about our favourite crime writers. So, Steph, straight into you and
name the novel.
Okay, is everybody ready?
Mm-hmm.
Ready? Pen poised.
I'm not even picking my pen up.
Me either.
I think you might surprise yourself.
Oh, this could be one for you.
This children's fantasy novel was the debut of a young man who had attended Manchester Grammar School. For Linda, that's in the northwest of England.
Thank you, Steph.
And it was written in his study at Toad Hall between 1957 and its publication in 1960.
Oh, I can think of one possibility.
Anyway,
everybody's thinking they might have got it, but
no, I'm not.
What's it called? Okay, clue number two then. The story borrows part of its plot from local folklore, and when it was published, it received much critical acclaim. But the author was later to say it was a fairly bad book.
I know what it is.
Yay!
Oh,
who needs a
pen? Anybody need a third?
I just can't remember the title or the author, but I know exactly what book it is.
Okay, here we go. This is the third one. Although he had always intended for the novel to be the first of a trilogy, and the second in the series was published in 1963, the third wasn't published until 2012, more than 50 years after the first of the tales.
Swindon the Willows.
No, that wasn't published in 1960.
Way.
That's Edwardian. It's Alan Garner. I can't bring the name of the book.
It's The Weird Stone of Brisingamen.
Oh, the weird stone.
I got Alan Garner, but I thought, which one is it?
It's also known as The Tales of Alderley because it's all based around
Alderley Edge. I had Alderley Edge in my mind and I couldn't get anything else.
Which is why I gave you the clue 50 years after the first of the tales, because, as I say, they are also known as The Tales of Alderley, those three books.
I thought when he said written at Toad Hall, I thought, oh, in 1960.
He bought a house in Blackdon. He was born in Congleton, which is in that neck of the woods. And the novel is set in Macclesfield and Alderley Edge. But he wrote it at his home, which was called Toad Hall, which is in Blackdon in Cheshire.
Right.
And it's a kind of medieval, it's a very famous building, medieval home.
Mm-hmm.
The Weird Stone is a jewel that one of the lead characters, Susan, it's about Colin and Susan, a brother and sister, and she owns a bracelet that has a tear-shaped jewel in it, and that is the Weird Stone.
Mm-hmm.
So they come to the attention of the Wizard of Alderley Edge, which is part of the folklore. Mm-hmm. Very, very famous.
So Toad Hall was a very naughty red herring then, wasn't it?
Because if you know the northwest of England, which is why I thought Pat might get it, if you know the northwest of England, you would probably know Toad Hall and Blackdon.
No.
You don't know.
Never heard
of it. Well, there you go.
No.
Okay. Right, sorry.
Well, I knew
exactly what you were talking about. I just couldn't remember.
I kept thinking Elidor.
Yes, in fact,
he wrote Elidor.
Yes.
The second of the books, just for everybody out there, The Moon of Gomrath was the second of the books in which the siblings light a fire on Alderley Edge. And the third of the books was called Boneland. That was the one that came out in 2012.
Why so long between books?
Well, because, as I say, he didn't really... After he'd written the first one and published the second, he said, well, it's a pretty bad book. But there were articles when he first announced that he was going to complete the trilogy. It was very much, foreshadowed, and there were articles written about it. So that's not that. Alan Garner, The Weird Stone of Brisingamen.
Well done, yeah. That was a good one.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Over to Linda to read from her work in progress.
Okay, we're back to Mary Magdalene and Eli on their journey. This excerpt, it happens at a carnival, when they've seen this carnival on the road. They've decided they're going to stop and go to this carnival. They had to find a place to park their rig, the trailer and the station wagon, which is rather hard to turn around. They found a place that's owned by a man named Blige Bullitt. Okay, and Eli gave him a dollar to allow him to park there. And so Blige gave him warnings about the carnival, etc. I think that's enough of a setup, so I'll read now. Eli was watching the man in the stall, but Mary Magdalene was watching the ongoing drama of Kenny and Thelma. A disappointed Thelma's lower lip was out so far she could trip on it. "That there game is rigged, honey," said Kenny. "I hit that duck dead center." Thelma wasn't convinced. "Oh, honey, come on now. I ain't gonna let that crook have any more of my money, 'cause I want to spend it all on you." The old man and the teenager nodded their approval. "Let's go on now and find something pretty to buy for you," said Kenny. That did the trick. Mary Magdalene was impressed. She had doubted that Kenny was up to the job of thawing Thelma out. By the time Mary Magdalene turned her attention back to the booth, Eli was paying for a chance to shoot the ducks. "Here's $3 for three shots, mister." Eli reached around to put his wallet in his hip pocket, just as a kid fell, hitting Eli's leg on the way down. The wallet flew out of Eli's hand. "Hey," he yelled, grabbing at the air that the wallet had just soared through. "That's my wallet!" Mary Magdalene saw the wallet leave Eli's hand, opening up like wings on an airplane. "No!" she screamed. She dropped to her knees and peered through the thicket of legs. There was the kid, the wallet in his hand. He quickly closed it, and she breathed a sigh of relief. A man reached down to help the boy up. "I'm sorry, mister," he said to Eli. "This here's my boy." He took the wallet and handed it to Eli. "I sure am sorry, sir," the kid said. "I tripped is all." Eli brushed the dirt off the wallet and put it in his pocket. "Well, I reckon there's no harm done," he said. Mary Magdalene's heart was beating double time. She took a deep breath and exhaled slowly. "All right, let's shoot some ducks," Eli said. He aimed and shot. Plunk. He shot again. Plunk. Again. Plunk. He held the gun in the air and whooped, "Three shots, three dead ducks," he crowed. "You pick out what you want, Maggie." "I want that fuzzy little yellow duck with the orange bill," she pointed it to the second row. "Why, that's just a little one. Don't you want one of these big ones? You can have any one you want. Ain't that right, mister?" Eli leaned in close to the carny man and looked him straight in the eye, holding his gaze steady and long. The carny man kept silent. "No, I just want that duck," she said. They laughed all the way back to Blige's house. Eli said, "It's a puzzlement to me, Maggie, why you wanted that little yellow duck instead of one of them big prizes." He took the little duck and turned it over in his hands. "Don't look like nothing special to me." "Well, first off, we ain't got room to carry much with us. And plus, every time we see it, we'll remember how we paid $3 to win a stuffed animal worth a dollar." Eli laughed and slapped his knee. "Well, Blige did warn us they'd take us for fools." Mary Magdalene laughed with him. She was filled to the brim with happiness that they'd had such a good time.
Oh, thank you.
That's changed a bit, hasn't it, since he wrote it?
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that. Just a couple of things that I wanted to point out, because I have to find something to say, Linda.
Yes, thank you.
Where you said to placate a disappointed Thelma whose lower lip was out, sticking out, I don't think you need to tell us she's disappointed because you show it very beautifully.
Okay.
So I think that's a redundant word.
Oh, thank you. That's okay. True.
And similarly, well, not similarly, but what you say, Mary Magdalene was impressed.
Yeah.
Again, I don't think you need to tell us she's impressed because there's lots of ways to show that she's impressed.
I had a note about that as well because it was kind of unclear to me. So I thought, was she impressed at how Kenny managed Thelma? Or knowing Mary Magdalene as we do, mightn't she not be a little bit sneery at how easy it was to buy Thelma off? I had a feeling she might look down on that a little bit, that she was a pushover, you know. But that was just a thought, that whether impressed was the right tone or not for Mary Magdalene.
Okay.
I quite liked it as a sentence rather than showing. I just like that. Mary Magdalene.
Yeah, and I think you don't have to always show. No. I think there's room for a tell, and sometimes, you know, I mean, this has come up before, these rules of writing, you can follow them too rigidly, and we're not robots, we're writers, and sometimes it's okay to, if it's the whole thing is telling, then it would be boring, but I think you're allowed to tell.
Just made me laugh.
Yeah, just that little phrase.
Yeah, the idea that I was watching this little pantomime and thinking.
Yeah.
Good move.
Yeah. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
My heart was in my mouth when the wallet was flying through the air and opening up like the wings of an aeroplane.
I thought that was a fantastic phrase.
I wasn't sure about the aeroplane bit. I thought perhaps a bird. I don't know. I mean, how many aeroplanes has Mary Magdalene seen in her life? Right. You know, so I just thought perhaps
that's
the wings of a bird.
That's actually a very good point in 1950s.
Yeah. But my heart was in my mouth and all the scurrying about in between the legs and everything. So are we to assume that the boys had the money away?
That's what I thought. Yeah.
I guess I thought.
Yes,
that.
Good.
And it's, you know, we had that writing day when you wrote it originally, and I think this version is much stronger because it's more believable in the fact that they could have, in the scramble and the, you know, all that business, had the money away, whereas the other one was a little bit, well, how do they get the money?
I think that bit was very good.
Maybe this is not where the money went.
Yes,
this is where the money went.
But I think earlier before, you know, in the 300 words I had to cut in order to make this
500
enough.
Words just isn't enough. Is it?
No, it is not. But Blige was saying how they'll take you and everything, and I think I'm going to have Blige add about how quick they are at doing that, because it had to be so quick and they are experts. So.
It's a great example, I think, the writing of it is a great example of writing the fast bit slow.
Yes.
It's all happening in slow motion, but it takes a split second for that money to be gone. They've got to be quick. Right. The hand is quicker than the eye.
Right.
So I thought that, I think that's a great example.
And the thing with Kenny and Thelma was that Kenny had shot before and he had been, you know,
cheated.
Yeah. And he's trying, and Thelma was really hoping for the biggest teddy bear up there.
Yeah.
And then she was very disappointed that he wouldn't buy more tickets and win it for her.
Yeah.
Mm. So that's why she was all out of sorts.
Yeah.
And so that's why Eli then moved close and looked the man in the eye, like, yeah, I'm not going to buy this. It's rigged, you know.
Mm-hmm. I understood what was going on.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
But I didn't quite understand why the guy on the stall sort of let him win anyway.
Because I think he might have a riot if somebody didn't win. You know, that was my feeling.
And also, Eli's just shot three times accurately. He's probably thinking he might have a piece tucked away.
Good stuff.
There was one speech where it's Thelma. No, it's not Thelma. Sorry, it's Kenny. This is where I was confused. Oh, honey, come on now. I ain't going to let that crook have any more of my money because I want to spend it all on you. So the first reading, I thought, why is Thelma saying that? So that just needs, because Thelma is mentioned in the previous sentence. She crossed her arms and looked away. And so that it just took a couple of looks for that to sink in. Mm. I love the... where she says, we paid $3 to win this $1 toy. I thought that was classic Mary Magdalene. And I thought it was a lovely, vivid scene. And it's great to see Eli and Mary Magdalene having some fun together.
Mm. Yeah. Getting on.
So
that's
lovely. Lovely.
Mm. Well, thank you all very much for that very helpful critique. Thank you.
Thank you. And now we're going over to Nicola to amuse us.
Yeah, well.
Do your best, love.
I've got to tell you, I don't find these bits very easy to prep at all, but in the spirit of our theme of crime, ooh, I have some amusing crime stories for you. Mm. We'll see how we go. For a trio of drug thieves, it was their lucky day. These dumb criminals broke into a home in Silver Springs, Florida, and discovered 3 jars of cocaine. They took it home and snorted the contents. That's when they discovered the jars were, in fact, urns, and that they were snorting the remains of the victim's husband and 2 dogs. When an attempted robbery at a Lewis home improvement store went awry, Milton J. Hodges fled across the street and jumped a fence right into the Cypress Cove nudist resort and spa. As the Orlando Sentinel pointed out, as one of the only folks wearing clothing, Hodges was easily spotted by police. It's the worst possible time to faint in the middle of robbing a bank. But that's what happened to a Beaver Creek, Ohio thief. The teller called 911 and asked for medics. But you have to applaud the man's stick-to-itiveness. When the ambulance was en route, the suspect handed a note to the teller demanding all her cash. I've got a couple more if you're enjoying
it.
Don't you hate it when you suffer a heart attack and think you're going to die? So you confess to a 17-year-old murder, only to find out you're not going to die, and then get sentenced to life in prison as a result. Yeah, so does James Washington of Nashville, because it happened to him. And then there's one more. Following a dispute, Craig Aylesworth of Bithio, Florida, see, they're all Americans,
yeah,
allegedly tossed a Molotov cocktail at his neighbour's trailer home, just as the wind shifted, sending embers onto his own trailer. Luckily, he was arrested because the dumb criminal no longer had a home of his own.
Poetic justice.
There's some wonderful inspiration in real life, isn't there? I could just see stories with those kind of events in them, almost larger than life.
The urn one particularly took my fancy.
Well, truth is obviously stranger than fiction.
And not all criminals are masterminds.
No.
Brilliant. Okay, Nicola and I interviewed Sam Blake this week, and hope you all enjoy it. Today we're interviewing Sam Blake, the author of 3 best-selling novels, Little Bones, In Deep Water and No Turning Back. Hello.
Hello. Hi there.
So I suppose just to start off, when did you first start writing?
I started writing originally in 1999. My husband went sailing across the Atlantic for 8 weeks on a yacht race called the Atlantic Rally Cruise, and you go from, I think it's the Canaries over to, where'd you go from? I can't remember anyway. He went, and it was a long time, and it was November, so it was very sort of long, dark evenings in Dublin. And I was working for an event management company, and I didn't even have a computer then. I think I just started working, I was just learning how to use their computers and that type of thing. But I had an idea for a book. I had all these long evenings stretching ahead of me. And I thought, well, I'm just going to start writing. So I literally started writing longhand because I didn't have the computer. And then I'd go into the office in the evenings and at weekends to type it up. And then by the time he got back, literally the bug had bitten. I was completely absorbed in the story and loving the whole writing process. And he got back and he bought me a computer for Christmas, and that was it. I think he probably regrets me going away now because he hasn't really seen me since. I'm always buried in the evenings and weekends and stuff writing away. So that's really how I started.
And what at that stage, what were you writing?
Okay, so that first book was a book called The Poison Tree, and it was pretty terrible. Obviously, I thought it was a bestseller. It was going to be absolutely fantastic. And so I sent it out duly, left, right and centre. I did all the wrong things. I literally put the last full stop down and started to send it out because I knew nothing about publishing then at all. Had no idea how it worked and just sort of thought I'd written this brilliant, amazing book and obviously everybody's going to love it. And so I sent it out. And Julie got rejected everywhere. Everywhere there was a publishing house, and I sent it, got rejected. But I was absolutely sure that it was going to be you know, really successful. So I kept writing and I started book two then. I can't remember the title of. And then book three was a book about a character called Charlie McShane, who was a detective, called Dead Reckoning. Just remember that now. And then I think I wrote book four. Basically, eventually, by the time I got to about book five, that was Little Bones that you're reading now. But it was called The Dressmaker. So, but all through the writing of these various things, I was sending them out. But I was also learning more and more about publishing. And I wanted to, I realised, I went down to Dingle, a lovely, beautiful, beautiful place down in Kerry called Dingle, and went down for a writing workshop. But in order to go, I had to fly my parents in from the UK because I had two small children then. And I had to put all the lists on the fridge and freeze everything. And, you know, it really was a major performance. So I went off to do the workshop and realised that, yeah, I could write. So all this sending off of manuscripts and writing of books was worth doing. But at the same time, knew I needed to improve my writing. And that's how really Inkwell came about, because I then got back and my husband's in the Guards. He's in the Irish Police Force. And because he was working shifts, it meant that I couldn't get out to an evening class or, to do a workshop like a weekly thing. So I decided I'd set up my own workshops. I wanted to hear from best-selling authors and I knew exactly what I wanted. I wanted like one day intensive courses, like literally, and I decided to set them up and start running them once a month, and that's sort of where everything started.
I'm astonished that you kept going so long. That's a lot of rejection. Most people would have given up after the first
book. Oh yeah, the key thing with writing and the best advice I was ever given is just keep writing. I mean, the thing is, you only get better by writing. And Malcolm Gladwell talks about the 10,000 hours. You know, you reach a tipping point after 10,000 hours in anything, and it's exactly the same in writing. And so that means that you're going to have to write. You might have to write two or three books. Now I work with new authors who want to get published like all the time, and I'm always saying to people, you know, it might not be that first book. Often that first book is your learning ground. It's where you know, all the autobiographical stuff goes into it. It's where you learn, I suppose, how to write. And, you know, it might not be the second book or the third book. But, you know, if you're focused on anything enough, I believe that you'll get there. I think it's just a case then of working out what your definition of success is in terms of how you want to publish or, you know, what it is you want to do. But absolutely, you just have to keep writing. Yeah, and you will get there. I mean, I know so many people, have worked with so many authors over the years, literally hundreds of them, and so many of them have got published, have got that deal. So it is just hard work.
Wow. Yeah. So what would be your typical day?
Typical day. My days are quite mad because I run actually three companies, four sort of. So I run the publishing consultancy Inkwell, and I run writing.ie, which is the website. So Inkwell does a lot of readers' reports. We're a bit like there's a company in the UK called the Literary Consultancy, and we do that type. It's basically a literary consultancy. So we would do a lot of reports on books. So let's say you've finished your short stories and you don't have a supportive writers group around you to help you make them, you know, to know whether or not they're working, then you can send it to us and I have a whole panel of professional authors who then will read the book and do your written report on it. So that's what we do most of. But I suppose the interesting side, the more interesting side is that is trying to place manuscripts and find authors and talk people. And what might could be useful for your group is to talk people through the most commonly made mistakes. Because I work with a lot of authors just over the years, last 20 odd years, I've worked with so many different people. I also run a literary agency called the Rights Bureau, and I now run an events company called Murder One Events. And so taking today as a typical day, this morning I had to drop the kids to school, drop the first one, my son, to school, and got back here. And we launched Murder One this weekend. So this is a festival that's happening in November in Dublin. And we've got Michael Connolly coming in from the States, and we've got Linda LaPlante, and we've got the most amazing lineup. It's incredible. Mm-hmm. But that literally went live over the weekend. So I've spent all morning answering people's emails and trying to fix all the bits where I made the mistakes on the website. So I'm going through just trying to do that. At the same time, I've had a manuscript back in from one of my readers from Inkwell. So I've just sent that out to the author. I've another guy making inquiry about a manuscript that he wants to get read by one of my readers. I'm waiting for contracts for another client to email them about that. Who is a guy called Dr. Harry Barry, who's amazing. That's on the agency side. He's published by Orion, and we're just waiting for his contracts to come in. And that's kept me going, really. I did a bit of shopping on the way home from school. On the way in. So I haven't written anything yet. Oh, I tell you what I did do, though. There's this amazing Instagram feed called Post Secret. And there was a thing on that that I just saw over the weekend. It's where people, it's a brilliant idea. These everybody, loads of people in America and all over the world post their secrets on postcards into this guy called Frank in America. And he publishes the secrets completely anonymously. But just in terms of for anybody who's writing as a place to get ideas, it's great. So I saw something really cool on that over the weekend. And I'm not going to tell you what it is because it's top secret, just in case somebody else. So I sent that to my agent this morning. And I said, I had a quick chat. I had just got his reaction on that because I was like, there's a whole book in this just right here. If you just go into Instagram, you put post secret in, and he publishes them every Sunday. And some of them are quite mundane, but some of them are really quite strange. And he puts them up on the website, and it's fascinating. Just, yeah. Just a font of ideas.
Yeah. So you've got a new book brewing just from seeing that?
Yeah, I've just submitted a new book that's with an editor in London at the moment. I'm hoping to hear back from her this week through my agent to see whether or not they want to publish that. That's a standalone book. It's different from the Cat Conley's. I wrote that in over about 3 or 4 months at the start of the year. And then I've also just started a new book, which is, when you get to it, if you get a chance to read the third book I've just written, which is No Turning Back, which came out in May. There's a character in there called Anna Lockhart, who I really love. So I'm just writing a spin-off book with her in it. So I've got that. I've been doing just tons of research. It's set in the middle of the hot summer because I got fed up writing books about when it rains all the time. So that's going to be a hot book. And so I've just started that, and I've got about 10 or 12,000 words of that done. But yeah, this is another new idea. So you tend to always have ideas while you're in the middle of something else and you can't get to them, so you have to park them. Yeah.
Oh, great. Did you intend to write a series when you started the Cat Conley books?
I wrote the first book was called The Dressmaker, and that's called Little Bones now. And I had the idea for the story about the bones turning up in the hem of the wedding dress. And I knew who some of the characters were, but I didn't have Cat Conley right at the very start. So I spent a lot of time writing my way into the story and writing about the different characters. And originally, there's actually one paragraph that's now in Little Bones, which is where Zoe's, I think she's in the artist studio with Max, and she has a flashback to remembering making the piece of artwork that she's displaying, the triptych. And that, in fact, was the entire prologue. So although it's only one paragraph now, when I wrote the first version of that book, that was like 3 pages, so 1,500 to 2,000 words of that as a prologue. So it changed hugely as it sort of developed, you know, as you get into the story and you get to know the characters. And really it got to the point where I suddenly realised that you couldn't have bones turning up in heaven wedding dress without somebody actually finding them. And then it was a case of, well, okay, so who's going to find them and how? And then, well, we needed to bring the guards in too. So that's literally when I started writing the scene, Cat Conley, it was like Thirsty was downstairs with his box of, you know, his big steel box, yeah. Dumping it on. I could hear him putting up down the tiles. And that was Cat Conley. And then Cat Conley walked into that bedroom and literally jumped off the page. And it was like she was waiting to go. And I absolutely adore her as a character. And so she was, she pushed that book all the way through then the rest of the story. And I had ideas for second and third books. But when my agent sold that one to Bonnier, he emailed me. This is the type of way my day normally goes. He emailed me at 2 o'clock to say, what's the series development on these books? And I was like, what series development would that be? And I had to go and pick my son up from school at 2:30. So I literally had half an hour to write the series development for the way they were going to go, or the way I thought they were going to go. And that's on that basis, then he was able to sign a 3-book wow. deal. But it was a bit mad because he'd had the book for a bit, and then he literally had lunch with Mark Smith, who was running Bonnier on the Thursday. And he'd had it for a while, and you still get rejected even when you've got an agent. So he'd sent it in to lots of different editors in London, and a lot of them would come back saying they loved the voice, but they had a voice that's too similar, or they already had an Irish detective story, or, you know, they had an Irish author already, or whatever it was. So there were lots of no's all the way along the line, and I'd sort of forgotten about it, really. I was busy doing other things and doing work stuff, and he called. So anyway, so then it was a series. So I'm very pleased, but it was funny because when I wrote, you'll see in No Turning Back, I thought she was going to get her master's in criminology and she was going to become a criminal profiler. So book 4 effectively would have been her getting into being a criminal profiler. But I realised as I was writing sort of books 2 and book 3, that wasn't the type of thing that she would do at all as a character, that actually she'd be bored witness stuck behind a desk. So, yeah, so things change a lot by the time you get to book 3.
She's a very immediately likeable character, and she's got a real feel of a loner, you know, sort of loner at heart, but she's, you know, she works in this team and everything. Mm. But she's very immediately likeable and relatable.
Yeah, that's lovely to hear. Yeah, I mean, I love her. She's that type of person. She's very independent. She's she knows her own mind, but she's obviously working in a team of men the whole time because I think there's only 25% women working in the Gardaí. So she has to be quite self-reliant too. It's the type of job where you have to make decisions very quickly, instantaneous decisions, you know, when you get to a scene or whatever's happening, and you're in control of that situation entirely. So from the point of view of, I suppose, of people going into the job or, you know, wanting to become police officers, it's a bit different from, you know, if you're working in an office, you tend to, you know, stop and think and maybe have a chat to your colleagues or whatever. But that's the type of job where literally you have to make decisions. And she's that type of character. She's somebody who's able to do that and is confident enough to be able to do that. So, but at the same time, she's got all sorts of other stuff going on. As you know from the start of Little Bones, she's managed to get herself in a bit of a mess. She tends to do that, jump in with both feet before she's really thinking. So
I'm just still wondering whether she's ever going to kiss Dawson O'Rourke.
Oh, well. she does, but you might have to wait a while.
No, I am intrigued because it's set in Dunleary, and I have been to Dunleary because my ex-husband's best friend came from Dunleary.
Oh, wow.
But it keeps reminding me of Worthing for some reason.
Does it?
Some of your descriptions. Yeah, I grew up in Worthing, and some of your descriptions about the arcades and everything is, you know, the seafront and everything. It makes me think of Worthing. I just wanted to keep it in there.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, no, Dunleary. Yeah, Dunleary is, well, it's, I suppose it's a Victorian seafront type place. Yeah. And Worthing's a bit like that, isn't it? Sort of. And I've been to Worthing. It's a gorgeous place. So, no, it is. I think it's important. It's important for me to try and get a sense of place, so that you, even if you've never been to Dunleary or you've never been to Dorky or you've never been to Dublin at all, that you get a feel for the place and you can see it. That's really important. Part of Little Bones is set in the East End of London too, and I've lived in the East End of London, so that was a case of trying to make that real for anybody who hadn't been there, because I think location is nearly like a character in a book if you do it right, and Kathy's very much part of her location, I suppose. So
Dunleary makes me smile every time I read it, because the very first time I came across it as a place on a map, I didn't say it properly. Because it doesn't look anything like it.
It doesn't. Some of the Irish names are very hard to pronounce, it has to be said.
So my last question is, are you still kickboxing?
Not so much. And I haven't even managed to get to the gym this week. Isn't that terrible? Yeah, I did it for ages. And then I did it all the way through book two as well. And it was mainly when I was writing the scene, there's a big fight scene at the start of book two that I really had to get right. And so that was when I really got stuck into it in a big way. But you have to be so fit for kickboxing. It's just insane. And I've let it slip a bit.
Yeah, I thought it was amazing that you did it, you know, for the character. I just thought that was superb.
It was great fun, but I was much fitter. That would have been about probably three years ago. And I remember going in and being absolutely the oldest person that they ever had in their class, ever, with all these lads. It was all because it was 99% men, and they were all like in their 20s. And my God, they're so tough. The first couple of times I went, I literally wasn't able to walk for about a week. I would literally I'd be groaning every time I got out of the car, and oh my goodness. But it's really good. It's very good all round. But yeah, but it helped hugely. I don't think I couldn't have written her fighting without trying it, because it's that whole experience and understanding, even just watching the guys in the gym and chatting to them and understanding what it's all about. I think that made a huge difference, because I think you get as a writer, you can do a huge amount of research on Google Maps, you know, Street View, and be Googling different things, and obviously you could watch videos on YouTube, but there's nothing like experiencing it. And that, for me, I just find it, the book I'm just writing at the moment is about a terrorist thing happening in London, and I was in London in July, and it was just baking hot, and it involves London buses. So we went on the bus, my daughter and I went out of Selfridges, and we went on the bus and we did all the various bits and pieces, and we followed the bus route, this particular bus route. And it's when you do that you suddenly realise there are other things, there are other coincidences that you haven't thought of and you couldn't possibly see. So my character, there's one particular character in the book who's in Selfridges just before this thing happens. And when I walked out of the food hall, I discovered that the bus stop was right outside the door of the food hall, which was, I would never have known if I hadn't, like, you know, actually physically gone to check it. Anyway, this is all very deeply significant for the plot. But there are all lots of little bits like that you suddenly find you know, where there are connections, or you discover you've made a completely massive mistake. There's another bit where I thought he was going to, this particular character was going to get off the bus at Hyde Park Corner and then walk around the corner into Belgravia. And I was trying to work out how long it would take him, and I was there with my Google Maps, and like they were saying X number of minutes. And when you actually do it in real life, it's like 30 seconds. So I didn't have enough time. If I'd have written it that way, there wouldn't have been enough time for him to do what he needed to do. Get up into the Irish embassies in Belgravia. This is where he's going. So he goes up into the embassy and then look out the window and see what's happening to this bus, because the bus would have been long gone. But you only realise that when you actually do it. So yeah.
So you're a method writer then.
I am. I like to be in the place and write about places I know. But yeah, I think you learn a lot when you're plotting. I find plotting is the hardest thing. The characters, I can cope with characters, but the plotting is always, that's always difficult, to try and make sure that it's really interesting and you've got the hooks and, you know, it keeps going. But I love doing that. So I love, yeah, I love doing all the research and finding out what's happening and, you know, yeah, getting right into it.
That's great. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah,
it's been really enjoyable.
That was great fun. We had a whale of a time.
Yes, she certainly did. Yeah. Calm down now.
She was really, really giving in her time and her information and efforts to help other writers.
That's brilliant. Yeah.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Daunting.
So now we've all got to read Sam Blake as well. Now.
Yeah. Oh, I've read the first one.
Have you?
Yeah, it's good. I liked it. I'm just holding back on the second because otherwise I get sucked in too quickly.
Rationing your pleasure.
Yeah. I've got to say, I had to read the second one straight away. I was so engrossed in the first one, and at the end, I just had to read the second one.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant.
Because the ending of the first one does
spoilers.
I'm just going to say, it does leave you wondering what the hell's going to happen next.
Brilliant ending. Yeah. Brilliant ending. And that hook, you know, it's good for me. It just got me. And you've got to read the next one. So,
thank God for Kindle and instant gratification.
But that's not what Pat's going for. She likes to defer her pleasure.
Yes, she does. She's so disciplined.
it's a British thing, you know.
Oh, right.
It's more enjoyable if you have to wait till the end of the week for your cream cake.
It's the old boarding school ethos, isn't it? Life is not.
Then I won't feel bad because, as American, is it okay if I can't defer gratification?
Absolutely.
And I don't know whether or not I should really resent the fact that these dumb criminals are American.
I'm sure there are dumb criminals in Britain.
Oh, thank you, Steph. Yeah,
sure. I mean, certainly with Sam, she was fascinating about how she builds the characters and the stories. Mm. And you said earlier on about, you know, there are rules to follow, but you don't have to do it.
Yes.
Yeah. And
you need to know them so that you can then break
them. And, you know, you hear about, you know, you should plot your stories and these three phases and all of that kind of thing. And she kind of debunked that by just saying, she writes, you know.
Yeah.
And it comes, and, you know, Kat wasn't the main character when she started.
That's right.
It developed, as she said in the interview, and it developed into it, and it's just amazing.
Yeah.
And she got the inspiration for the first book, Little Bones, from an old reporting of an old crime. I think it was in an old newspaper or something. And so she had the bones of the story, and then as she was writing, Kat, who was just a police officer supporting role to the main detective, just leapt off the page at us.
It became a heroine.
But I would have thought, actually, for a crime novel, knowing where it's going is more important than in other kinds of novels, let's say.
You would think you need to know who's committed
this crime, what's happened, you know, how it's come about.
That's interesting.
I
would imagine that some crime novelists do plot it with an inch of its depth.
Perhaps it's important to have the crime plotted out, but not necessarily know how the characters are going to develop as the crime goes along.
But she actually says,
doesn't she, in the something at the end, acknowledgements and so on, that she didn't know where.
She didn't know how the bones got there.
No.
Right.
Until
amazing.
Just eventually came to
it. It's a very clever premise in the first place, but it's a little bit creepy, it's a little bit weird, it's a little bit, you know, you can sort of see how that, you know, you're sort of imagining what kind of difficulties the person who did the thing was under, you know, she really makes you start wondering all these different things while you're reading it.
But I think that's the skill with crime writing, isn't it? It's to have unanswered questions. Mm-hmm. Well, in any writing, you want people to wonder what's going to happen next and how something came to be. And I think, in crime in particular.
I think it's that idea you're saying about, you know, how strong the lead character is. And I think it's that creation of a character that the reader can really sort of become invested in. Mm-hmm. That when I think over my other, like, favourite crime writers, they've all got really strong characters that you care about and that you want to.
Well, I just come fresh from one of your recommendations, V.I. Wachowski, and Kath Connolly shaping up very nicely in the same way.
Yeah, true. Yeah, you have to be interested in the characters. It can't just be a puzzle.
You have to care.
It's a different kind of writing where it's just a puzzle to be solved, you know. You have to, you know. And if it's got, you know, if you, for a series of books, there's a key character is important. I've just discovered a new-to-me writer. I'm reading at the moment Robert Wilson, A Darkening Stain. I don't know if any of you have come across this. But again, I think it's the fourth in a series with the same main character, Bruce Medway, who's a private detective. But it's set in Benin in Africa. And one of the things that he does, which is brilliant, the opening scene shows a truck is coming out of the port laden with secondhand clothes. Mm-hmm. And outside the port gates are men and boys waiting to try and snatch some clothes off it. Mm-hmm. On the truck are six men armed with huge sticks to fight them off. Mm. As it comes out, the fight breaks out. People are somebody's trying to pull a pair of jeans. Somebody's got hold of a nylon 90. Mm-hmm. And a boy walks past who's nothing to do with this event. He gets hit by a baton and ends up under the wheels of the truck.
Oh.
Now, the heroine, or the main protagonist, walks past and witnesses this event and then goes on about his business. So immediately, you know, you're in a place where life is very hard, very dangerous. Yeah. It's a struggle for many people. And this kind of incident isn't even shocking, you know, to the guy, Bruce Medway, who lives in the midst of it. So it's got a great sense of place. It's very dark. He has been compared with Raymond Chandler, and there's a nice quote from Val McDermott, who's a brilliant writer, on the back, and she said, "Robert Wilson dissects the dark heart of Africa with an insight and compassion that makes it as sleazily that makes it so sleazily vivid, you'd pay money not to go there." So I'm really enjoying that. I'm not very far into it, but it's got a good plot. Lots of peril for the main protagonist, who's a private detective, would like to be kind of a straight guy, but, you know, the mafia want him to do stuff and the other people want him to do stuff and, he's embroiled in this very sordid life of criminals.
Yeah, that's good. That's great. That leads us beautifully, actually, into our favourite crime writers. Has anybody else got any favourites?
I'm not a particular fan of crime writing, but I do enjoy Linda LaPlante. I tend to like crime on television, so I really enjoy things like Silent Witness. I really enjoy television, so I enjoy things like Silent Witness, Prime Suspect, those kind of, series.
Linda LaPlante is just brilliant at that, isn't she? Yes. All of those above suspicion as well. You can watch them again and again.
Absolutely, I'm not a great lover of gore.
Right.
And that's why I think reading, when something like a kid going under the wheels of a truck, I'd have to go, and just throw the book away. I wouldn't want to read it.
Right.
On television, you can kind of hide behind a cushion, can't you?
Yeah.
I'm the opposite way. I can't watch gore and violence.
Yeah, I can't be
it's less vivid when you read it.
I love, like, Patricia Cornwell, who goes into literally forensic detail about stuff.
Well, I think on television they might shock you occasionally, but they don't actually. It's not quite so visceral as some of the writing, because you get the, as when good writing, you get the picture in your head.
Right.
And sometimes I want to shut my eyes, and you can't read and shut your eyes. Yeah. It doesn't work.
No, but visuals get into your head and they won't go away.
Yes.
And speaking of gore, I'm reading, among other things, a book called Quite Ugly One Morning.
Oh, Christopher Brookmeyer, yeah.
And who's the author?
Christopher Brookmeyer.
And in the very beginning, there are so many bodily fluids.
Yes.
You know, all of every kind you can imagine. And it's just, I hate going through that. I'm thinking, come on already, stop.
But he's quite a humorous.
Yes,
I like Christopher Brookmeyer because there's a lot of humour overlaid on the, I can't remember the name of his detective, but there's quite a lot of humour there. Yeah.
I'm still wondering where the title came from, Quite Ugly One Morning.
Well, it's a play on Quite Early One Morning.
Right.
And all of his books are like that. It's one of his books is called... Big Boy Did It and Ran Away.
I know that some of the others just have these very funny titles that make you want to pick it up.
Yeah.
But then...
The Unsinkable Rubber Duck.
Yeah.
he's got some really quirky titles.
Oh, it sounds good. I don't know him.
Do you not?
I don't think so.
That's great. You'll enjoy him. Yeah.
I think my favourite has to be... Sarah Paretsky,
I'm really enjoying it, I've got to say.
You know, thinking about favourite, because
there's so many.
I read loads and I've worked through so many. But I think if I had to sort of pin it down, Sarah Paretsky and Ian Rankin.
Again,
it's a genre I absolutely love. I mean, it's police procedurals. I should have been a policeman, really, because I just love it all. But I had to. I knew you guys would all talk about all the other ones I loved, so I just started looking at these books. Had a big impression on me, and then actually looking at the author, he what a story it is. The girl with the dragon tattoo, Carl Stig Erland, Stig Larsson. And not to be confused with Stig Larsson. And he wrote the Millennium Trilogy, which were published posthumously. So he didn't even get published in his own lifetime. And then they were turned into motion pictures. I found the heroine very intriguing.
Yeah, she's a brilliant character, Lisbeth.
Yeah, and Lisbeth, you know, that first book, she'd been through so much, which explains so much about why she is like she is.
Very, very... dark.
Yes, very dark. But
I did read them all, but again.
And interestingly, one of the strongest influences originates from his own country, Pippi Longstocking, who was one of my favourites as a child. I love Astrid Lindgren, she's a brilliant writer.
She wrote my favourite book, Ronnie the Robber's Daughter, but that's another story.
Yeah. Well, Lisbeth was fashioned on a grown-up Pippi Longstocking. And actually, the reason he wrote so powerfully about abuse of women was that he witnessed, when he was 15 years old, he witnessed three of his friends gang raping a young girl, which led to his lifelong abhorrence of violence and abuse against women. Yeah. And his longtime partner, Eva Gabrielsson, who didn't end up benefiting at all from the incredible wealth that was generated from, you know, because they weren't married, said that this incident marked him for life in a chapter of her book. And I just found it, the author never forgave himself for failing to help the girl.
James Ellroy has some similarities, though a very different style of writing, because his heroes, if they are heroes, I mean, they're often very compromised. But they always have, or generally have, this thing about defending women and hating abuse of women. And his mother was murdered. It was a sex crime, unsolved sex crime. So he wrote The Black Dahlia and all of those things. It is interesting.
How it formed you.
Yeah.
Well, I just thought, what a sad story, you know. His incredible books, but really sad stories about him personally.
Absolutely.
And what did you say at the beginning about his name?
His name is actually Carl Stig Erland Larsson. And known as Stig for short, Stig Larsson for short. But there's another Stig Larsson. It's said particularly not to be confused with the other Stig Larsson.
Well, right.
Which I don't
know who he is, so it's not likely to be confused with in our world anyway.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably confused us all now.
I mean, we all love a good crime novel, and it's a good page turner or whatever. But I don't know if you have any thoughts about why... But I've got a little article where some authors talk about why they think it's successful.
Yeah, love to hear
it's also
that.
Popular.
Yeah.
Come on.
I mean, I like the fact that you for me, it's trying to work out and trying to sort of think the next stage and, oh, how does that fit in? And I find that really, really entertaining.
Yeah. We find ourselves trying to be the detective along with the detective, don't we?
But I'm rubbish at it, even though I read. I never, ever.
But there's a satisfaction, isn't there, because the ending has to be right. If you don't get it and you think, no, that's not right, that doesn't work, that doesn't fit, that's disappointing. Yes. You feel cheated. So it has to be correct, and you have to feel satisfied with the ending and at the same time not get it or not get it too early. If you get it right near the beginning, then you still, I know what's happened.
Yeah, so, yeah, one of the writers here, Michelle Davis, said exactly that. She said, layering of clues, twists and red herrings to build a story that both puzzles and wrongfoots the reader is what makes it so enjoyable. Crime fiction really is the most interactive form of reading. Readers are essentially armchair detectives. So,
that's true.
This article, it's from the UK newspaper, The Daily Express, from April. And according to figures at that time, from the London Book Fair, Britain has become a nation obsessed by crime fiction. No fewer than 18.7 million crime novels were sold last year, a rise of 19% since 2015. Other writers they talked to, Linda LaPlante, and she said, similarly, I think it's the mystery of following the plot and working out who done it. Matthew Blackstead, crime fiction lets a writer confront the world as it really is in all its ugly glory. And these days, some of the ugliest places exist online. Through our smartphones, we're using tools we don't understand to share our deepest secrets with people we don't know, and bad things can happen as a result. And he's saying that his books let readers explore this kind of threat in the safe environment of their armchairs.
So it's similar to reading children fairy stories, isn't it? We're exploring the things that
Or the witches by Roald Dahl. True. So, I mean, I have other quotes here. Sarah Vaughan, crime fiction allows us to explore our darkest fears, as you were saying, Nicola. The world is an uncertain place right now, and the closure offered by a crime novel can be comforting. The perpetrators of the crime will usually experience justice. So that's quite important too, I think. You know, when, I mean, I think with James Ellroy, you don't get that certainty or sense of closure. You end up thinking the world is full of, you know, corrupt politicians, corrupt CIA, corrupt everything, you know, and it's just choose your least worst bad guy.
Right.
Right, well, thank you very much for that. We're nearly at the end. But before that, we're going to go over to Pat, who's going to tell us what's on her bedside table.
Well, you may be or may not be surprised to know that it's from the genre of crime fiction. It's actually the second book in a series that I've just discovered by Joseph Knox. And this one's called The Smiling Man. And it's the follow-up to Sirens.
Yeah.
Which is set, well, both of them are set in the seamiest parts of Manchester, of which there are several. And the first one, Sirens, introduced Detective Aidan Watts. Quite an interesting character. I enjoyed the book, but had reservations about it, but I enjoyed it sufficiently to think, yes, I'll go for the second one. There's enough about it. And in the follow-up, he and his partner are summoned to the Palace, a vast disused hotel in the centre of Manchester, and there they find the body of a man.
Mm-hmm.
He is dead. And he is smiling. This is how it's introduced in the blurb. You think, that's a good hook, I think.
Yeah.
And apparently everything's been removed from his clothes, his teeth have been filed down and replaced, his fingertips are not his own, only a patch sewn into the inside of his trousers gives any indication as to who he was.
Right.
I'm intrigued already.
I've read Sirens and I loved it, and I think Joseph Knox is a great young writer. I actually hate him because what a great first novel. So I'd love to read that.
And it's got some good reviews. Ian Rankin calls it gritty as hell. a great urban cop thriller. Val McDermott, Sirens is a powerhouse of noir. Joseph Knox owns Manchester and paints it in all its grimy colours. And I think that's being from the Manchester area. I think that was one of the things I enjoyed about Sirens. I always do. I liked Val McDermott.
You like to recognise
Castaigne cliffs and stuff.
Well,
they're all based there.
If you recognise it, there's a certain enjoyment of that. But if you don't recognise, like Benin, as I was talking about before, it's still taking you to a new place. But because it's got a strong identity, that it's enjoyable, I think. Like the Black House books that are set on Lewis and Harris. I love those because it's such a different place, a different environment.
The setting becomes character almost.
Yes, it does. Absolutely.
Well, I love Peter James because he writes about Brighton. And it was funny when we were talking to Sam, she described Dunleary, which is a place I've been to just once, but it could have been Worthing. You know, she even described this little shop in an arcade that had been, it used to be a jewellery shop and has now turned into a musty clothes shop. And when you walk in, there's that smell of musty clothes. And there was a shop just like that.
Seaside towns are kind of the same in Britain and Ireland, aren't they? But I think Dunleary is a place many of us have been through the ferry port but never seen the town.
Well, for those of you Americans, they're all describing places in England.
And Ireland.
Dunleary's in Ireland, right. Places that I have not visited, and probably many of you haven't either, just to let you know.
So don't you have kind of seaside towns in America that are a little bit run down?
Canvey Island.
And little secondhand shops.
What island?
Canvey Island?
No.
Coney Island.
Canvey Island in London. My niece lives on Canvey Island.
Coney Island is a little run down.
Yes, but for the most part, any beach villages are filled with luxury homes.
Different. It's different. They were working class resorts of the 19th century. Right, so they're all...
It's cold in our seaside towns. That's the difference.
Okay, thank you. Well, that was Write Club, the podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher or Radio Public so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. Join our Facebook group. Just search for Write Club, the podcast. Please leave a review and please tell your friends about it so we can grow the audience. Bye.
Bye. Bye.